Kevin has been in the industry for over 42 years of experience in the field of public safety. He has all kinds of certifications and licenses, from firefighting to hazardous materials and special rescue operations, disaster preparedness, incident command, emergency medical services, intelligence analysis, private investigation, personal and execution for executive protection, security consulting, and security officer training. All in that brain over there. Prior to founding Array Enterprises, Kevin was an assistant chief in the Department of Public Safety for the city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He supervised several special investigation units, including the Arson Strike Team, which is a multi-agency team of federal, state, and local investigators focusing on arson for profit financial crimes. There's a lot of stuff in the world.
Which is routinely carried out by terrorist organizations inside the U.S.
Awesome.
Probably 30% of our arrests were terrorists.
Wow. He's conducted specialized training, investigations, and security programs throughout the world and has worked on high-value asset programs, including the NASA Space Shuttle program, the U.S. United States Air Force B-2 stealth bomber program, and he's worked on numerous personal protection details for United States presidents, foreign heads of state, dignitaries, a papal visit, and corporate officers of both domestic and foreign corporations. He's conducted hundreds of investigations on issues ranging from incidents of terrorism to fraud and tampering. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Kevin Mallott.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for the invitation to come out and present to your group. I have a long side history in aviation. I started out originally to be a fighter pilot in the Marine Corps. And then it was suggested to me that I was more mentally suited for other parts of the government. I'm like, I kind of like flying now. To give you my age, I started out and the plane of choice was the F-4 Phantom, which I called the ground shaker. But moving past all that, getting up to modern times, to our major project, we're very pleased to be involved and sad but pleased at the same time, is that after the Challenger accident, we were hired to look at the astronaut rescue program and everything from Cape Kennedy, Cape Canaveral, all the way to launch and return. And then we redesigned the program, changed quite a bit of the functions at the Space Center and so forth. And then we also got rehired after the Columbia, and they brought us back in to look at all the communications issues. The other one that was mentioned was the B-2 project. And our focus on that was crew rescue and nuclear weapon recovery. So we designed a lot of the response and recovery programs specifically for overseas incidents. If we lost a plane outside the U.S., to go get the equipment and the personnel and get them out of there. The actual lead to the Space Shuttle project was also kind of the same thing. Some of you may be aware that a lot of the Space Shuttle missions were DOD-funded missions. And it was a big concern, our TAL, you guys familiar with that, Transatlantic Abort Sites, in Gambia, took the shuttle right into Libya if they overshot. And what some of the things that the shuttle was carrying, we did not want Muammar Gaddafi to get his hands on. So we were brought in to figure out how to do a really fast entry, extraction, recovery, and take off from wherever they might land or show up. Important to remember with the shuttle is it didn't fly. It coasted back in. So if there's an overshoot, there's no flying around coming up for a second pass. So anyway, that's a little bit of my exposure there on the aviation side. Other than that, I am an air assault instructor, and I like jumping out of helicopters. You know, the modern stuff with the fast roping is the later stage. Our early stage was rappelling on split half-inch lines, and then the other was 300-foot parachute openings. So jump out and release your chute at 300 feet and cross your fingers that it works. But in any case, I'm a real helicopter guy. And that kind of brings me into this. My background, my whole career has been public safety, and I've worked as a firefighter, paramedic, law enforcement, intelligence analysis, and military special rescue operations. Those are my field of activities, which at no time did I ever think would lead to anything that made sense other than I was having a good time doing all this. And today, with the terrorism incident, it actually all makes sense. Kind of all comes together with no plan, I might say, that we would have those various background expertise areas focusing in on the kind of people we're dealing with in the terrorist organizations. So I want to get into our presentation here. I also have a whole lot of support info. And I want to pass out here, we have a very, very good electronic library. So if you're ever looking at anything on safety or security, and I mean from, you know, your own personal security walk around Fort Worth to international terrorism, just give us a shot. We have a lot of good information on file. Our company's philosophy is we'd rather educate our clients up front so they stay out of trouble. But if they get into trouble, we send response teams. So we do both sides, but we really prefer to educate first. The whole scenario with terrorism that most folks aren't locking into is that the primary goal of all major, and I say major terrorist groups, because there's a lot of them in the world that are not Islamic extremist based. But Al-Qaeda, and I was mentioning before we started, I remember when we trained bin Laden. I remember when he was a member of the Mujahideen, and we trained him on how to use, you know, manpads and all sorts of stuff. Okay, so Al-Qaeda was trained by the U.S. to defeat the Russians in Afghanistan by ruining the infrastructure. It was never about military to military. There's no way they're going to win. Same thing as they're not going to win against us military to military. It's basically they made Afghanistan such a wasteland, the Russians left. And the whole idea was economic disruption. You kill the economy, the Russians are going to leave. I mean, they're very singularly focused. If they're not making money on the deal, they're out. So that's what it was all about. Well, that's what Al-Qaeda turned back to us. And you need to remember that ISIL is a subdivision of Al-Qaeda. They were Al-Qaeda in Iraq before they became ISIL. And that's what happens when you get ambitious subordinates. You know, they create their own mission and they got going and they became bigger than Al-Qaeda in most terms. To start off, I got to tell you that the problem I have as a American citizen watching the news and watching a lot of things going on is you have a bunch of good people that have absolutely no idea what evil is. All right, so there's a difference between being stupid and being naive. And there's a difference between being stupid and being ignorant. Okay, and in my personal opinion, we have a lot of people that are uneducated, ignorant, and naive, but they're trying to be good people. They're trying to do the right thing as a good person. You don't deal with evil from a good person perspective. You have to deal with evil from a heavier position than the evil position. So when we start off, we have all these people say on TV, I do some work with a couple of different radio and TV networks as a contributor, and there's people on some of the panels. I just want to take them outside and say, look, you know, you got to get a grip. Or go with me, we'll do some work in Central Africa for about 2 months, and then we can come back and you can talk about your perspective. The fact of the matter is, you can't think like a good person in Dallas-Fort Worth and think that's going to solve the problem. It has nothing to do with the motivation of the bad guys. And by the way, that motivation is changing. It's actually, we saw in Paris and Brussels show a whole new different approach in the mentality. While we don't get it, I want to point this out to you, make sure you lock in. In the past, terrorists that carried out terrorist attacks, in most cases, had no combat experience. And they were willing to die on the mission, and their job was to go carry it out. And if they get killed in the process, that's okay, as long as they get the mission done. What we have now is thousands of military combat-hardened individuals who are now going into the civilian world to carry out missions. And if you look at this, and I think most of you guys understand the military model, look at what happened. They hit Paris, but not everybody died. And the guys that didn't die in the attack went on to hit Brussels, and a couple more died, but the other guys that didn't die have gone on, and they will carry out other attacks. And they're not killing off their combat-experienced guys. You know, all the people that know how to really do the job, they may lose one or two acceptable casualty load, right? But the rest of them are going to hit and hit and hit and hit. And in the past, they never had to worry about that because you got three guys and none of them had experience. So if you lost them in a terrorist attack, it's no big loss. Now you got guys with 5 years of hardcore combat and doing insurgency in urban environments. You don't want to lose those guys because they know how to do it. So if you watch, you're going to see this. Every attack, they'll lose a couple, but there'll be several that get away to do the next attack. And it totally makes sense if you're a bad guy. From the American side, most folks still haven't caught on to that. They haven't noticed that they intentionally had guys leave. Remember in the Brussels attack, the guy with the hat? Okay, two of the guys with carts have their hands on the cart. Why? Dead man switch. Let go of the cart, cart blows up. How do you open the door if both hands have to stay on the cart? Or even one hand? You've got to have a third guy, the escort. The guy with the hat was the escort. He's the one that opened the doors to get him inside with the carts. But here's the new part about this. A normal terrorist attack is a backpack on your back or a suicide vest. When you start using carts, it's because the weight is too heavy to carry. And if you look at those devices, they had all sorts of shrapnel and so forth in the devices that caused massive collateral damage in the area, which is why they had to push them on a cart. So in the past, we're looking for that guy wearing the suicide vest, right? Not now. It's not a car, but it's not a suicide vest. It's on a cart. So the third guy goes in, gets him where going, and he splits. He's on another attack. So this is part of the underlying they're going to hit over and over and over. That's part of their major plan. But I want you to understand that if you are even talking to other people in your organization and they're very good people who've lived a good life, good chance they're not going to get this. On the other side, I've had people say, geez, I should have known that. I'm like, actually, if you understood all this, your friends and relatives wouldn't like you. You know, if you get bad enough to understand how the bad guys really think and operate, there's a good chance at the family reunion you'll be at a separate picnic table. So just kind of keep that in mind. Not everybody fully wants to get into how and why. The director called me from the FBI, stated a couple months ago they had open investigations in 49 of 50 states. They are here, and I want to show you something real quick. And by the way, anything I show you, if you want a copy, Helena Bell at the back of the table from our office, just let her know and she'll get it to you. This is the ISIL manual for operating inside the USA, how not to get caught. It is a published book that tells their agents in the USA what to do to avoid being detected by federal and local law enforcement. Now, when someone says to me, you think we're going to have an attack inside the U.S., when they have a training division that's producing a published manual of how not to get caught in the USA, it doesn't say in France, it doesn't say in Belgium, it's about in the USA. Here's your travel and transport security chapter, how to build a safe house, homeland security, your cell phone security, what you do. It's all about defeating U.S. intelligence and U.S. law enforcement to operate inside the USA. When they produce a manual, I promise you, they have guys here that are using the manual. They didn't produce it not to have it in circulation. Why I think this is important, especially in your industry, if you want to make sure they're not working in your workforce, you better understand how they operate. And so all of our clients that we do security for their facilities and for their executives, we make sure that these manuals are read by senior managers and anybody who's hiring anybody from an overseas visa, or anybody who's got someone on an internship. Make sure they read this and understand if you see that person operating in line with things in this manual, that should raise a flag. Doesn't mean they're a bad guy. It means you better be paying attention. Okay? So as far as are they going to come to the U.S., yes, they're here. They already wrote the manual, and they're operating without a lot of hindrance right now. However, as the director said, we've got open cases going on in 49 states. Six people in the USA were indicted on February 7th, 15th for providing material support and resources to the terrorists. Those are six Americans. And this is what I think is probably the most unique aspect. As we have seen, we've got people that lived in the U.S. for a period of time that are participating in this. A second statistic that's kind of interesting is the first quarter of this year, we stopped 19 individuals from being smuggled into the southern border from Afghanistan. Okay, 19 Afghan nationals were apprehended in different arrests at different times in the first 90 days. Last year, we had two in the first 6 months. Okay, so just kind of think that one through and remember that usually as we do better and better from a pure military perspective, terrorism rises. Can't take them on head to head, so you go to the terrorist mode. Hundreds of arrests and interventions have also taken place. They stopped a couple more plots 2 weeks ago. And if you really sit back and watch, you'll see it on the news every so often, but the news doesn't really focus on it. They don't want to talk about that our counterterrorism policy and our terrorism program overseas hasn't worked out so well. So they just kind of blow right by it. I think most people are aware that most of the media outlets are somewhat biased politically now, which is a sad state of affairs. But the fact is they are. So they don't put stuff on the front page that kind of doesn't support their political philosophy. Okay, the killing of Ambassador Chris Stevens was a raise-up, if you will, on the level where they go to. But we don't have time to get into this. But that was a kidnap attempt. I don't care what anybody else says. I can show the whole thing out to you, lay it all out, how they did it and so forth. It was a kidnap attempt that went bad because they had an idiot on the kidnap team who set the place on fire. But for that, they would have kidnapped our ambassador and been down the road, and that would have been it. And here's the reason why. And this is why I'm telling you this. The reason for the kidnap was to extort ransom from the U.S. The U.S. has never paid ransom to terrorists before. Okay, up until the Bo Bergdahl fiasco, we never gave terrorists money for anybody as a hostage. If they had kidnapped Ambassador Stevens as planned, the U.S. would have either paid to get him back or admitted a total failed policy in North Africa. And by the way, the guys that did that were AQIM, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, the guys behind this attack in Benghazi. The point of that was not to kidnap Chris Stevens, he's just the piece. The point was we could then have them kidnap every oil executive in the U.S. rebuilding Libya, and we'd pay and pay and pay and pay. And that would be their ongoing fundraiser to supply AQIM with the money they need to operate. And so if you look at Libya, all the American companies were coming in. Everything from military support to oil and gas, and everybody else was returning back to the old days. I remember the old days. I had an uncle who was very high up in Mobil Oil, and they had a bunch of facilities in Libya, and Gaddafi nationalized all of them and took them. Well, all the American companies and other Western countries were going back into Libya after Gaddafi's demise to rebuild and start all of that production all over again. And AQIM strategically thinking is we need to be able to kidnap those executives and get paid. But to do that, we have to reestablish the U.S. policy of paying for hostages. So the first guy you grab is the ambassador. How would the administration not go for that one? And then it all went bad. Okay. But there's all sorts of key things that we can talk on the side about Benghazi today. If you step back and look at it from a military approach, you can tell what was going on and all the crazy stuff, including the fact, and don't forget this, that the fatalities that occurred at the CIA annex at the end involved people who flew from Tripoli, came over, drove through the enemy lines into the CIA compound, and then were killed. Because the compound was surrounded at 11:30 at night, and those guys flew in and drove in at 4 in the morning. Okay, so there's all sorts of stuff that you go, wait a minute, how? So that being aside, this is a big deal. This is terrorism figuring out economically how to squeeze American businesses. Does that make sense to everybody? Even though it resulted in the death of several people, four people, and the ambassador being one of them, it wasn't about that. It was about squeezing our government for payments so they could fundraise to keep their organization going.
So have American businesses, are they on hold now with moving?
Yeah, I mean, and you know, the prime minister the other day said he's stepping down. I mean, Libya is just totally, it's like trying to dance on marbles right now. And unfortunately, where our policy is being run by people that think jurisdictional borders make a difference, the terrorists have no jurisdictional border. I mean, realistically, we look at Boko Haram and AQIM, and they're rolling all over the place. Yeah. Al-Shabaab, you know, we've been killing some of their top guys in the last month. They've mostly hung out in Somalia, a little bit in Ethiopia and Kenya. Get ready for them to start rolling around, because by staying put, they become a target. But most of these guys have absolutely no jurisdictional control that they worry about. And in fact, ISIL has people now in the northern part of Africa, what we call MENA, Middle East North Africa sector. ISIL got people roaming all over the place, and they're supposed to be Syria-based, you know. So I think we'll see more of this coming on, and I think the U.S. businesses have been very, very cautious. If you'll note, the last three bad attacks in Africa were all business hotels where Americans stayed for business. And I think they pretty much have got the point across after the last couple of hits that this is not a safe place to be putting execs. If you do go in, you need to have a team. When we go in there, we're wearing ceramic body armor and all this, and we go in, we don't tell people we're coming. We blow in, we have a meeting, we leave. We never stay at the same hotel where the meetings are. There's all these things that are doing to keep everybody off balance. Anybody who says you stay there for 5 days and then you go to your meetings, you're asking for trouble. You know, and the problem is, and this is interesting, but I have executives go, yeah, but that other hotel is not very nice. I'm like, yeah, but we get to live. So if you look, all the attacks have been after the higher-end hotels for the area, at least, what they consider higher-end. And they know that's where all the Westerners stay. So they're hitting businesses. And at the same point, I think because some of the people that have done the hits have not been super well-trained, they haven't grabbed anybody. They usually get into a gunfight, and then it just spirals out of control. But the idea of grabbing an exec is right in line with what they're trying to do. Okay, some key terms and definitions. I want to make sure we're all on the same page, because a lot of people talk about terrorism and really don't know what the definition is. And I hear people all the time say something's terrorism when it's not. Okay, a true terrorist act, and this is from our federal law, U.S. Code, is against non-combatant targets. If you attack a military base, that is not a terrorist attack. It's a military action with enemy combatants that are not in a nation-state military. But it's military personnel are supposed to be armed and able to defend themselves. Okay, and I can go back to Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and you remember that. At one point, watching guys playing tennis on the tarmac at an airbase just outside of Riyadh, and I said, you guys are aware of the fact that the T-72 tanks that they have can be here in 93 minutes. I mean, that's how close we are to the Iraqi border. No. Yeah, really? No. Yeah, I'm telling you. Well, we'd have notice. Okay, tell me where in an hour and a half you're going to come up with a gun and some body armor versus a tennis racket. It was kind of interesting, some of the people's mentality. Like, yeah, we're here, you know, sooner or later. Because remember, we went from August to January before things really lit off. The air war was going on, but a lot of folks didn't lock in on the fact that it's not like way far away. You know, the other country and the other armies on the border, not too far from here. So hitting a military target, which we did, they eventually launched Scud missiles and we had some casualties. That's not terrorism. Okay, that's hitting a military target is a military attack. It's war. It's a non-combatant that gets targeted when you become a terrorist. So that is people that are civilians that are not armed or equipped. There's even in foreign governments, and by the way, remember, if you're going to fight an adversary, you need to understand their perspective, not just yours. There are foreign nation state areas where they consider the police as an acceptable target because in so many foreign government areas, the police are military. So if I go throughout Africa, where I work quite a bit, and in the Middle East, there's police that are military-based personnel. So they look at like, well, someone attacks the police, they just attack the military. Here in the U.S., the police are civilian compared to the military, but they're still uniforms. So their perspective of police being an okay target and ours are two different things. But what counts for countermeasures is not what you think, is what they think. And if they think police are okay, because in their country they relate them to the government of the military of their government, then police are an open target here in the U.S. In fact, they are. We just all got bulletins that came out that ISIL has been hacking into accounts of current and retired law enforcement personnel, and they're publishing lists of home addresses of these personnel and sending them to their cell personnel in the U.S. So we already know of three major databases that were hacked, and they went after the home addresses of law enforcement, both retired and current. So it's not bad enough that our own OMB loses our addresses and background files. Now we get the bad guys going after them, too. All right, so I just want to make sure we're clear on that non-combatant issue. The next thing is the FTO, Foreign Terrorist Organization. I'm going to talk about that for a minute, but the FTOs are actually formally organized terrorist groups. There's a lot of terrorist associations, if you will, that haven't made it to FTO status, but they have to have certain capabilities, and I'm going to touch on those quickly. The FTO, keep in mind there are now 53 of them as of January 2015, and there were 37 in 2005. So foreign terrorist organizations are increasing rapidly because they're getting away with it. That's the bottom line. It actually works. If I look at most of the attacks that the terrorists do, I go, yeah, that makes sense because it worked. They pull it off. They got what they were after. Their motivation, their mission was satisfied. And then usually they had pretty good coverage from the media at the same time. So this is important that they're expanding. And when I say FTOs, remember, that requires you to have a lot of certain components to be considered an actual FTO. Okay, before September 11th, there were 29. So September 11th was, hey, they're not so bad. You know, we can go right downtown and hit them in their home areas. That really created a whole lot of smaller groups that start gelling together and go, hey, wait a minute, we can take these guys on. So that was besides being a terrible incident for our country, it was a philosophical mind shift for the bad guys of the world that we can be attacked, that we are susceptible to be on the losing side. There are 30 to 40 terrorist groups that don't qualify as FTOs, and I'll get into the elements in a minute, but they all want to be FTOs. So if you look at the capacity with 53 now, we could easily end up between 90 to 100 foreign terrorist organizations in the next 5 years if we don't start stomping on them. Historically, some become FTOs, others do not. So let's look at examples. There are regional causes, political causes, ideological shifts that make a group go away. You know, a treaty is signed, a deal is made, political acceptance. Somebody gets put into parliament, and all of a sudden that group dies out. So not all of them become full-fledged FTOs, but a lot of them do, and a lot of them want to. Increased success of the FTOs makes more groups rise. You get more and more splinter causes, and ISIL is a perfect example. Again, they were part of Al-Qaeda, but Al-Qaeda wasn't moving fast enough for their point of view, and they saw the instability in Syria and said, hey, we're going. Al-Qaeda Central said, no, that's not a major target of ours. And big difference, by the way, Al-Qaeda, main organization, does not want to kill other Islamic individuals. ISIL says it's okay to kill anybody, including other Islamics, if they're not supporting the cause. So you're either on board their bus or they run you over. Where Al-Qaeda Central, because of their funding and where they got their origins from, don't go looking for a fight with other Islamic groups. Okay, so that's the big split difference between the two. The methods, motives, and capabilities differ between the FTOs. They all have their own little reasons for doing what they do. And they also have a different acceptable level of what level of violence they'll carry out. Some basic motives that we need to be aware of. Political change, and that means everything from complete government change to policy change. And ISIL's capability, by the way, you hear people say ISIS. Their real name is ISIL, and that is the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant. Levant is a French term. It means rising in the east. In the 1300s, when the French merchants were heading east in the Mediterranean, when the sun came up, everything they saw on the horizon was the Levant. That is Turkey, Cyprus, Lebanon, Israel, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. That entire curve on the eastern end of the Mediterranean, they want all of that. However, as they started out calling themselves ISIL, they ran afoul with the king of Jordan and the king of Saudi Arabia. The two monarchs weren't real keen on that idea of them reestablishing the Grand Caliphate of the 800 and 900 year period, and realizing that they would depose the monarchs to take it over and put it under the Grand Caliphate. So a lot of problems caused fundraising issues and a lot of support issues. So they curtailed that Levant concept for now, not permanently. And they ran over to ISIS, Islamic State. Okay, so their real goal, though, is the entire Levant. They want the Grand Caliphate back, and they want to run it with the head guy being in charge. Somewhere around Damascus will be back right where they were originally, the main concept. Okay, with that in mind, we have people doing it for financial. And right now, I'm going to get into this in a little bit. The problem for American businesses, they need money. The oil price has plummeted. We blew up a lot of the oil fields they were stealing oil from. We blew up a lot of their tankers that they were shipping the oil to foreign countries that were buying it, which, remember, who's your buddy, who's your pal? Yeah, when our pals are buying oil from the terrorists that are killing everybody, we need to have a little chat with them, too. But the scenario is that financially, what ISIL is shifting to right now, and I've got a document up here from the State Department. One of my duties is I'm on the Overseas Security Advisory Council with State. And this is the new little pamphlet about the CCA, Caliphate Cyber Army. Okay, they are now attacking U.S. businesses and trying to steal money by penetrating U.S. business sites through cyber attacks because they're running out of cash. We blew up two of their cash depositories. I don't know if you guys saw that, but they had these two big bunkers with hundreds of millions of dollars, and we blew them up. And then we took out the oil convoy, so they're running low on cash. They've reduced the perks to the members of the ISIL Army. They get paid less now and have less perks. So they're going to go steal the money from American businesses. With that in mind, while I'm up here, I'll mention this to you. Helen, you got one of those cybersecurity flyers? I don't know where I put mine at. Just hold it up. There was a cybersecurity and economic espionage forum on May 11th. It's being put on by the U.S. Department of Commerce for any company that works on the international level. Okay, you know, USDOC encourages companies to work overseas. However, what's going on is companies are going overseas and they get a virus on their computer, they have a cyber attack, they get their porthole injected with corrupt code, and it's from working with the international level, they then bring it back into the U.S. I didn't mean for you to pass those out. Anybody who's interested, I just want to let you know we have these. But it's on May 11th, and I actually am doing one of the presentations, and we've got a couple other guys doing a real good job of the international threat, and if you people travel overseas, or you have guys in your companies, what they need to be aware of. And what's really going on right now is the top target group for the bad guys is the 250 to 500 person company. because they don't want to attack the big companies. It's too hard to do that. You attack a company who's a supplier to the big company. Big company gets an invoice every month. Every month they get that PDF invoice. Pay it, open up, pay it. And then all of a sudden, it's got an attachment with corrupt code, and the main company opens it from their vendor, and it's in their system. Now they've got access to the main company. That's caused a whole lot of lawsuits and a whole lot of vendors to lose their contracts. So that mid-sized company, and it may be even 2,000 employees, but that company that works with the larger corporations is really the target of the terrorists right now, because they know that's where they can make an easier penetration than a main corporation that's got all sorts of data people running around doing day-to-day cybersecurity activities. But that's a big issue. Financial, where we all thought, hey, they just want the world to be radical Islam. They do, but they need money to operate. You know, so their motives are starting to split across the board. Ideology, obviously, we've got that problem going on. They want an ethnic state and a new government. I'm going to talk about that in a second. But the religious cause and what you see with the Islamic extremist groups is actually guiding how they operate, but it's not necessarily the motive for every attack. So you've got, you know, various missions that create the bigger strategic picture. And we have to be careful not to get caught off guard thinking, well, we're not a religious group, or we're not opposing their religion, so we're not a target. If you got cash, they want your money. You know, if you're working in an area and you have a transportation hub that brings in military supplies that oppose them, they need to take out your transportation system. Does that make sense to everybody? It's not just singularly focused the way a lot of folks approach this. And then, of course, then you get into the activists and you actually get into genocide. And we recently had that conversation in Washington where they're marching all the Christians down to the shore of the Mediterranean, cutting heads off. Is that, in fact, genocide? And that for the average person, doesn't mean a lot, but it means a big deal at the international law level when you start talking about how the international community responds to that. Responding to a civil war is one thing. Most countries say hands off. Responding to genocide, most countries are into that because of what's happened in the past. So it really raises up the bar on who could participate in countermeasures. Okay, so the essential elements of an FTO, I just want you to be aware of. It's much more organized than most people understand. But you're dealing with finance, communications, command and control, a unifying vision. Everybody has to have an ongoing unifying vision to get them to cooperate and do what they need to be doing. Training, recruitment, and then central to all of those things is the terrorist group. Keep in mind that we thought in the past that, you know, the terrorists, you know, they're living under a rock someplace. Guys in Brussels, Paris, are living in a nice place with money, cars. You know, they're funded. They're not living under a rock. They're not out in a cave someplace. So it's drastically changing. To do that, you got to have a good support system. Targets directly related to the motivation of the group, and I just want to cover this, and by the way, this PowerPoint presentation, if you want a copy of it, let Helena know, we'll send it to you. So I'm going to move kind of quick here, but some of this you may want to refer to later. To attack a target for an FTO, they got to have media coverage. The easiest thing for you to remember, September 11th, 2001, what visual sticks in your head? Most people remember seeing that second plane fly through the building. Okay, let me ask you a question. How is it that we got the second plane flying in through the building on video? Both planes took off from Boston at the same time. Well, one of them didn't come in for 22 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever it was. There's no question from my viewpoint, they had an on-the-ground controller that when the media set up, they called them in. And there have been some evidentiary points we're not going to talk about to support that. So they hit the building one plane, the media shows up, sets up all their cameras on it, and then they bring the second plane in. They know how we work. They know how to work the emotions of the American public. And we saw that second plane hit the second building for a month straight, 24/7. So the media coverage is real important for them. If they want to get across, you want to terrorize people, you need to have people know about what you did. Cutting the heads off, it's kind of ancient time stuff. I mean, back in the days of the Persian Empire roaming around, they thought killing 100,000 a day was standard. You know, so when we look at it today, our perception of what's terrible is really minimal compared to what it was long, long time ago. But these guys do that because it terrifies people. You know, you could shoot somebody and that's bad, but cutting their head off is just terrifying. So that's why they do it. It catches on and the media coverage is there and it freaks everybody out. It makes them seem like a much more capable enemy than they actually are. Elimination of political foes and adversaries, damage to adversarial resources, Recruitment funding. If you want to get more people, you got to be an action-oriented group. The reason ISIL has grown to over 40,000 personnel is because they went out and did something. Al-Qaeda was being too dormant from the perspective of the leaders of ISIL. So they go out and do bad attacks. Every time they do a horrific thing, they get more people signing up. They're action-oriented. So myths and misperceptions, criminals and terrorists are the same. No, they're not. It drives me crazy when every time they say, we're going to try a terrorist as a criminal. Yeah. No, it's totally different. The criminals don't want to die, number one. Number two, that is their ongoing enterprise, and it's usually because it supplies them with what they need to live. Whether it's thrill, excitement, cash, whether it's it's a revenue stream, whatever. Criminals are not on an ideology, and criminals will flip on each other 90% of the time also, where the terrorists will die without going to talk because they support the cause. It's a much different type of commitment. So you cannot take them as the same. They are not. And they don't think the same. And the other side about it is the penal code, the crimes code, is not written for terrorists. It's written for a person that is either A, going to be executed, or B, is going to be rehabilitated and put back into society. I mean, if you look at the way the penal code is written, it's not written for the terrorist type mindset or motivation. So we got a lot of big issues on that one. The terrorists, another myth, they're created to oppression. No. Some of the top terrorists were very well educated. Until we killed him a few months ago, Ahmed Abu Samir, who was in charge of the social media attack unit for ISIL, he had a doctorate degree from Northeastern University in Massachusetts. Okay, there, a lot of these guys are highly educated. They came from good homes. But they've got a mission mentality that's a little bit different, okay? And we even look at the people in the U.S. that have become extended agents for these organizations. They're not oppressed individuals, okay? They're not living in poverty. People who are in poverty, again, when I work on the ground in Africa, they would like the bad guys to just leave them alone. Like, just get out of our area, let us live our lives. They don't, because they're impoverished, they don't round up knives and machetes and go cut heads off, okay? So that's kind of a way off track, as I call it, the myth. And it's promoted by certain individuals that would like to believe that's the cause of this. Geneva Convention is applicable. No, it's not. Geneva Convention applies to uniformed members of a nation-state military. It does not apply to people that don't wear a uniform and attack non-combatant targets. So there's a whole lot of weird stuff. Does that cause a problem? Well, it has been inhibiting the way we respond to these guys, and they use it as a wedge to continue their attacks and continue their success. Eventually, by the way, and what happened in September 11, 2001, if you kill enough Americans, we will get mad enough to go do something about it. And that's it's sad, but, and I can't tell you what the magic number is. I will tell you that on September 11, 2001, almost everybody knew somebody who had a friend or a relative who either died, was injured, or worked in New York that was impacted. Once almost everybody in the country knows someone who was impacted, whether it was just out of work for a year or lost $1 zillion in the stock market, closed for 5 days, or lost a loved one, you get enough people impacted, everybody wants action. But we're kind of a country where things are so good on a day-to-day basis, we really don't get dragged into it unless it's a really big incident of magnitude. By the way, the terrorists know that, and if you look at the way they operate, they've been operating just below that level. Keep hammering away, but don't get to the level where the U.S. freaks out and starts attacking everybody. And it's actually worked pretty well for them. Islamic extremists lone wolves? No, they're not. Every time someone calls them a lone wolf, I get upset. They're remote agents. They are not lone wolves. These guys are trained, motivated, funded, and guided by headquarters. That's not a lone wolf. Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, he was a lone wolf. He had his own mission, his own reasons for it. Nobody knew what it was. And there was nobody associated with them. That's a lone wolf. But these guys are all in contact. They're all in communications. And I don't care how recent the communication was. They were motivated, inspired, which is the name of their magazine, Inspire. Gotta love these guys. They pick English words. They are being controlled and used as remote agents, not lone wolves. Respecting the culture, religion will preempt it. No, it won't. All the good Islamic people want nothing to do with the terrorists, and it has nothing to do with our response to it. This is a historic fight for them. I've dealt with these guys. I've interviewed them in the desert. They're fighting a battle from 2,000 years ago. Yeah. And it's got nothing. In fact, the Arabs are fighting a battle from about 400 B.C. with the Persians. It's got nothing to do with current response or attitude towards their religion. Government politics and law are separate? No, they're not. Not in their culture. And terrorism is a worldwide problem? No, it goes after where people respond. You don't see them going into really impoverished areas and killing a bunch of people because nobody cares. That's sad, but that's the reality. You don't see them going into the really, really low areas that have no media coverage, they have nothing that they will gain by doing the attack. They go where they're going to get a gain. So there are people in the world that are completely protected by this just by the fact that nobody wants what they have in their area. Extremist threat, it's a long history, and we talked about this a lot of this earlier. Keep in mind, the greater percentage of the Islamic population has no desire and has nothing to do with the extremists. However, when you see someone that says, well, worldwide it's 3 to 4% support the extremist views, when you have billions of people in the religion, 3 to 4% is in the millions. And that is a concern. And yet we know pretty much where most of those folks are. And even if they support it, doesn't mean they're going to carry out an act. But it is an issue that sooner or later we're going to face. Distribution by motive, just to let you see there, there's 62% of the FTOs are Islamic extremists. So 62%. 27% have other motives, and 11% are tied to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So if you look at it, you'll see that the other motives being the ETA in Spain that wants to have a vast separatist region. You know, they've been blowing stuff up by northern Spain, southern France. The IRA when they were active, the FALN, the FARC in Colombia. Those guys, all those other guys are 27%. But the big chunk that's causing the problem, and we're growing fascist, is the Islamic extremist groups. Locations where they've taken hostages, if you're in business, this is kind of a concern for you. You have to stop and think, where do I work? Because this is where they're taking hostages, and, by the way, is also where the local resources may be very limited. Local intelligence, local ability to rescue and recover a hostage drops dramatically in the areas where the terrorists operate, which is no big surprise. That's how they figure out where to operate. Okay. What I want to point out is very important here, the cultural difference. In Western culture, you have a political self, your legal, economic, cultural systems, your religious self, and then you have your ethnic background. In the Islamic extremist culture, it's all one. They have a judicial system, a religious system, a cultural belief system, a social norm system, and an ethnic system that's tied together. And it's all one. You don't get to separate your politics from your ethnic, your religion from your politics. It's all together. It's one big system. And that's one of the issues that makes it much more difficult to deal with, because you're not just dealing with their religion. You're dealing with their judiciary, cultural, social norms, etc. The best people that can deal with this are the good Islamic governments that understand how to moderate the history of the religion, the history of their cultures. But right now, we've alienated most of those big Islamic cultures and countries by some of our actions, and we need to get that back on track. And that's really, from my viewpoint, that's the big picture solution. One thing I will tell you, you have to be very careful about, is we've moved a lot of our semiconductor and technology production to Malaysia and Indonesia. And Malaysia's got 90%+ of the population under the poverty line, and 92% Islamic. And it's a heavy, heavy hitting area for Islamic extremism. Remember, the last meeting before the September 11th was in Kuala Lumpur. And that's where they brought all the top guys together to talk about the attack before they carried it out. So Malaysia and Indonesia, most people keep thinking Middle East, keep your eyes peeled on that, because there's a lot of business in that area that we do from the U.S., and yet it's a growing issue for them. Okay, another thing I want you to be careful about, remember there's a difference between Sunni and Shia, and they don't like each other. The Shia only represent 15% of the Islamic population, 85% Sunni, but it's a really dissident 15%. And what you got to remember is, when you're doing business, for most Americans, you don't think about, I'm doing business with a person. You don't think about their religious background or the overtones of their cultural or ethnic areas. When you work overseas, you have to think about it. If you start doing business with a country or a group that's on the radar screen of a terrorist group because they have a disagreement on religious philosophy, you just increase your target profile. Does that make sense with everybody? So Hezbollah is one of the most dangerous terrorist groups in the world. It blows my mind how everybody just goes by and forgets them. Last I knew, they had 120,000 members, and they were growing. They're all fully trained, fully equipped with military gear. and they have an operational base in South America now. Okay, so the bottom line is, no one's looking at Hezbollah. They have two drones that Iran gave them. Both of them have a 42 kg payload in the nose. These guys are serious players, and everybody's watching all the other guys while they keep expanding and moving on. And, of course, they're supported by Iran. If Hezbollah's got it in for a government that you're working with, or a supplier that also supplies the Israelis, or whatever, you can suddenly pop up on the radar screen. And it's the same thing with all the other terrorist groups. So when you start working with different countries that are in conflict regions, you really need to do a deep dive on all the things that country or organization represents and what adversaries they have and how they would look at you. I'm not saying you can't do work with them. I'm saying you got to be prepared. You do your countermeasures up front. You make sure your cyber defense is really good on your systems. You got to do a few things before you dive into that, and thinking much bigger picture than a typical American business deal. These are different groups: Sunni influence, Al-Qaeda, ISIL, Hamas, and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, which still has remnants floating around. On the Shiite side, you have the Hezbollah, the Mahdi Army, and the two major groups that are serious bad news players. And it's been amazing how they've been under the radar ever since ISIL started running around killing everybody. No one's focusing on these other groups, and they've taken advantage of that to grow. Okay, a quick thing about ISIL. They're very good with technology. They're great on getting their message out. They do formal publications like the manual I just showed you. They've got a TV show that runs all the time. They have all sorts of social media outlets where they show videos of how to make devices and so forth. These guys really, really have it good, and they go after disenfranchised individuals. Any of you know about Maslow's hierarchy of needs psychologically? They go after disenfranchised youth that have no belongingness. And they cultivate, you belong with us, we'll give you a mission, it's very important. And not only that, it's what God wants you to do. They are great at psychological manipulation. And really important that they consistently go out and send messages to their guys through social media what needs to be getting done. This guy we killed, he's the one I told you about, had the doctorate degree from Northeastern University. And he trained about 2,000 people on cyber code work and so forth. And they're now the guys that are in the new caliphate cyber army. Yep, here, just mention that. Get money, email, ransom, all this cyber stuff. I'll be happy to talk about that. One of my side deals is I'm a sector chief for the FBI's InfraGuard cybersecurity program. My two sectors are chemicals and nuclear. Okay, so if you've got any questions on that, I'd be happy to chat with you. This document I just got out, this comes out every week, and each of these items is an attack, a cyber attack, or someone arrested for espionage. Okay, I got 12 pages worth every week. Okay, it's ongoing like crazy. I've been involved in arrests and investigations of foreign nationals spying on companies in this area. There's a lot of activity as Dallas and Fort Worth keeps getting more and more business moving in. The bad guys come with them. They go, you know, the mice go where the cheese is, right? So be prepared for that increase. The ransomware deal, I want to mention this real quick. The FBI just put out this bulletin. Ransomware is where you get a virus on your computer that locks out all your data, and you pay them a fee, or they destroy your hard drive remotely. And it's grown like up 1,000% in the last 6 months. So far, $1.5 billion has been taken from this in the last year. It's a big deal. If you haven't heard about it, let me know. We'll get you one of these bulletins from the FBI about ransomware and what you do about it. But it's a big, big thing that the terrorists are doing too. And quite often, by the way, it ranges from $300 for a personal computer up to a hospital in Tennessee that just paid $17,000 to get them to release their data. But they lock down your hard drive data, and they've got a kill button. And if you don't pay, they wipe out all your data. Now, even if you have backups, some companies may spend millions and millions of dollars getting the backups online, and if they're offline for 30 days to do it, they could be out of business. Smaller company could be out of business in a week. So those are really important things to be thinking about. Why is the threat getting crazy? Advancement in technology and so forth. I'm going to give you my short version. In the last month and a half, I've been on three different continents and have been, you know, in different countries doing stuff all over the place. When it was the day of the wagon train, it was 7 months to go from the East Coast to the West Coast. 75% of people didn't make it. Okay. When you took a steamer, my buddy's great-grandparents took a steamer from Italy, and it took them months to go from Italy to France to England to the U.S. And then they got there and they had to sit on Ellis Island for 6 months. And now a guy gets on a plane and tonight he's here from anywhere in the world, including all the hot spots. And for a fairly economical price too. That's completely changed. The phone, I have a chart in our office for our cyber stuff that shows that certain countries have 3 to 4 cell phones per person in their population. Something's up on that deal. They're below poverty line, but everybody's got 2 phones. Okay, well, there's all this communications, there's this instant access worldwide. All the technology has now leveled the playing field from those that did not have a good military or military might to suddenly be able to interact and cause havoc on the international scene, whether it's corrupting a database or delivering a dirty bomb. And they all have capabilities now that they never had before because of the advance of technology. This is something to watch. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. That's a Arab statement from years ago, and it still is. I want you just to look at the convoluted mess we got going on here. The Russians work with Iran because they supply nuclear material for their nuclear power facilities. Syria is supported by Russia because Russia has only one warm water port to work on their entire navy, and it's on the west coast of Syria on the Mediterranean. There is no way they're letting Syria fall. If they did, the only backup they could possibly use is the Crimea, which, by the way, they went and took that as a backup in case Syria fell. But when they did that, the Turks immediately told them, you're not coming through the Bosphorus, so don't even think about it. At which point, they started flying their jets over the Turkish border to give them a little heads up. And then the Turks shot one of their planes down. So that's a mess in the making right there. But the fact is, the reason Russia is in Syria has nothing to do with being buddies with Assad. It's they can't give up that warm water port because that's where they do all the repairs on their ships. And the Chinese are trying to build a big naval base on the east coast of Africa, which has got the Russians totally freaked out because we're reducing a carrier group, so there's nobody watching what the Chinese are doing on the east coast of Africa. It's all tied to very logical issues. It's not knee-jerking, okay? It's just nobody wants to get into the mentioning of why they're doing it and what's up. Real quick, you got the different groups, and they're all fighting against ISIL. And here's my favorite, Anonymous, the cyber hacking group. This is crazy. When ISIL, and by the way, our government said, well, we can't really stop the social media, you know, we can't deal with the ports. Yes, we can. We know where they are, we know where their headquarters are, and we know how to shut the ports down. It's just we currently don't want to deal with all those foreign governments to tell them we're killing their internet access. But Anonymous, which has no rules, got mad when they did the killings of the Charlie Hebdo cartoonist because Anonymous is about everybody gets free speech and free information, right? So Anonymous attacked the ISIL servers and took them offline for 5 days. So a bunch of guys with Cheetos in mom's basement can take out these guys, but the U.S. government can't.
Yeah.
Okay, it's not technology-wise we can't. It's we don't have policy that lets us. Does that make sense to everybody?
Yeah.
But ISIL just, or Anonymous just announced the other day because they whacked a couple journalists. Anonymous says, gang on, we're coming after you again. So I'm going to be watching these guys. The crazy part about this is if ISIL ever starts retaliating, they're going to be blowing up homes in London and all over the place where these guys live. But they have been able to penetrate their servers and take out their portholes all over the world, let alone in Raqqa, Syria, where ISIL headquarters is. Countermeasures from the government. I know I'm running over real quick. I'll wrap this up. The countermeasures from the government is we need to go after ISIL headquarters. Everybody's been worried about collateral damage. I think most folks in the room know about our ability to pinpoint. And pretty much, if you've been living next to ISIL headquarters the last 5 years, sorry, but in my mind, you got to go too.
Yeah.
Okay? You're crazy. If you know those guys are next door and you're still hanging out. We should take out their headquarters in Raqqa. We should go after all of their portals, shut down their social media. We need to get Dr. Shaquille Afridi out of Pakistan. He's the one that gave us bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
And that set a very, very bad example to anybody that we're trying to make an informant. They're all like, no way. We saw how you guys treat your top informant. I'm not giving you anything. We need to get him out of there and let that be a case example. We do take care of our friends. Really get up the rewards. Some of the rewards on the high-value targets been terrible. I mean, you know, $1 million, they'll say, I'll give you $2 million to go the other way. I mean,
yeah.
You know, we haven't done our job on that. And we really need to revisit the intercept program with the NSA. I mean, it's I'm a practitioner. You want to do something, I'll get it done. You don't want to do it, I'm okay. I know how to stay safe. I know what to do if there's an attack. So I'm not too worried about myself, but if they want to take that down, they really need to reconsider. And if the U.S. is okay with losing 30,000 people a year to terrorist attacks, okay. And we lose 40,000 plus to cars. So they said there's a defined line. We lose 30,000, we don't get crazy. You kill 30,000 one, we're coming after you. But we don't have that. We don't have a strategic plan that lines that out. And we need that, and then we need to make it something that the American public will support. Cyber attack, I mentioned the cyber recruiters. This is it's hard to see this, but this is the anonymous logo, and that is the Caliphate Army. And they do it in dark black and red on the dark web. Makes it more eerie, more freaky, you know. Looks like the demonic stuff. You know, bottom line, the North Korea server, the North Koreans hired a third party to attack Sony when they did that attack. We identified all that. We can do that. I promise you we can get ISIL servers. It's just a question of being given the orders and the mission. And one thing you guys really need to watch right here, remember the UN is trying to take over control of the Internet. Last year they tried to do that in a UN vote, and they almost got it. The UN, if they take it over, will turn control of the Internet to the Security Council, which has China and Russia on it. And a couple of the other countries that don't follow all the rules. Okay, so that's really asking for trouble. Countermeasures personal. This is what, if you want this, ask Helena for the handout, because this is good stuff you guys should know. Always remember to get it down. People try to outrun a projectile. The slowest projectile is 900 feet per second. Yeah. If you guys can run that, the NFL wants to talk to you. Okay? So always get down, go for cover, containment, and get out. But have a plan ahead of time. Don't be standing around not knowing where the exit is. When an attack takes place, it's very quick. Now, the only thing I'm going to tell you from dealing with street crime and terrorists, if they yell, Allah Akbar, I'm on the ground. By the time they get to the end of the second word, I've already hit the ground because I know what's coming next. They don't yell that to say hello. Okay? So right away, if you're in a foreign airport traveling, you hear someone yell that, hit the deck. You may look silly if nothing happens. You may have to dust yourself off, but you're going to be alive. Most of the attacks, the projectiles, gunfire is always at 32 to 34 inches off the floor. Bombs are made to go out like this. Gunfire sprayed at the waist. It's not. They're not after you. They're after mass effect. You hit the deck, a lot of it's going to go right over your head. Then get out. Avoid your crowded areas. Don't be hanging around in the unsecured areas. Now, this is kind of like the crazy stuff of the TSA. As we saw in Europe, they're going to hit the unsecured areas. Everybody's backed up. I would tell you two things. Go prepared. All you guys have flown before, you know what stops you in security. Have everything out of your pockets. Have your belts off. Do everything so you fly through security. If you get through there faster, you're not standing in a collective group and you're less of a target. Secondly, don't hang around vending machines or garbage cans because those are nice places to put devices. Okay. Oh, yeah, back up real quick. I got to say this. Don't rely on cellular phone. You got to have satellite phones. How many of you guys have ever heard of GETS, Government Emergency Telephone System? Okay, we have a switch in the U.S. If things go bad, we're going to cut the Internet and cut the cell phones so that the government can use them. I have a little card that I carry that gives me code so I can turn my phone and laptop back on. Everybody else will be off the network and off the cell system. And that's a thing we tested here in the area about 2 years ago, year and a half ago. We cut all the cell phones off for the afternoon. Everybody's like, I can't get a signal. Yeah, that was a test. But the fact is, all throughout Europe, Africa, and Asia, they do this all the time, routinely, to avoid people protesting and so forth. The U.S. has the same system. If you're an InfraGuard member, by the way, if someone in your group is an InfraGuard, they can get a guest card as an InfraGuard member to keep the critical infrastructure going, which is an important point. But you need satellite phones. That's the only way you're going to communicate if something bad happens, because cell and the Internet are going to be shut off. And that's happened overseas. The big farce on Benghazi is that the portholes that showed that video were shut off in July. The attack was in September. So nobody watched that video over the Internet between July 11th and September 11th. Can they have a plan? Make it feasible, right? All right. Last thing, have strategic protection for all your asset categories. And look at your functional areas. And these are the big ones. Communications, finance, transport, and logistics. Remember overseas, like what happened in Athens, they closed the banks. Can't get any money. You guys have to be able to get cash. How many of you know you can wire cash to the embassy and you can pick it up? Okay. Yeah, the embassy will take cash for you. So make sure you've got all these things planned out. Harden your structures. Make sure your itinerary is controlled. And realize that the warnings that come out from DHS and so forth are, in fact, real. Reentry plan, real quick. I want you to be ready to get back in the U.S. A lot of execs have not thought about this. We get hit again, they're going to close the borders. Yeah. And you got to figure out how you're getting back. You know, we've got a couple extraction plans that we've rehearsed, and we've got ways of getting back in the U.S. But we get a bad attack in the U.S. and the airports don't open. You guys are stuck if you're outside the U.S. unless you figured out how you're getting back here. And there's ways to do it, but it takes planning ahead. The go bag, I'm sure most of you guys in the military know what I'm talking about there, but you should always have that ready because at a moment's notice, you need to be able to bail out of your hotel and get out of that area. And these are the basic essentials you need, including your medications or anything and a communications capability. Economic impact, I talked about all of this jazz. And if you want to know how bad it can impact your economy, ask Mexico what all this serious crime has done to their economy and what terrorism can do to your business. It can ruin your reputation. It can take your main, you may have a contractor coming to take your main client offline as well. So you need to be monitoring that so that you don't get yourself in an overextended position where economically you get damaged by an attack. The last one's here. I just want to cover this, and I'll be happy to talk to anybody afterwards. The U.S. Department of State, the Overseas Security Advisory Council, it puts out bulletins like what I held up before. It is a very good organization inside the Bureau of Diplomatic Security in the State Department. We have regional security officers at every embassy. Now, OSAC members get briefings. They have annual meeting where they talk about safety and security issues. But the biggest thing is you can exchange info. So I have guys on the ground in Africa in every country. If I'm bringing an executive in, I get a daily report all the way up to, and then while we're there, we have on-the-ground resources for intelligence gathering. It's very helpful if you work in an international setting. You may work in a company where you have a member, somebody in the company that's part of that, but if not, talk to me. I'll be happy to tell you how you do it. It's very, very valuable. The Department of Justice has the FBI InfraGuard program. That is the cybersecurity countermeasures, and now they have now assigned InfraGuard all hazards. So cybersecurity, terrorism, any kind of bad hazard out there, we're getting involved in that. There's a North Texas chapter meeting out at Dallas FBI headquarters normally, and sometimes we meet at the DFW Public Safety Training Academy at the airport. 16 infrastructure sectors were picked out by the presidential directive, and as I mentioned before, I have nuclear and chemicals, which chemicals is cosmetics to chemical weapons, and nuclear is medical isotopes to nuclear weapons, okay? Those are my areas, but there's a sector chief for finance, transportation, energy, all the 16 infrastructure sectors have a sector chief to focus on that. Communications program I mentioned, Homeland Security has a fusion center. The one I work with is North Central Texas, but that's all the government agencies sitting around sharing intelligence. Remember the shooting in Garland where the two guys rolled up and we're going to shoot the Draw Muhammad cartoon deal? The fusion center was activated, and we have intelligence agency, DOD, local police, fire, every kind of public safety and government agency has a rep in that center, and you share intelligence at the moment, but we also share intelligence ahead. And I mentioned before about the law enforcement addresses being put out by ISIL. That came through the fusion center from one of our intelligence agencies saying, you need to let your guys know that your area's been targeted by ISIL, and they're putting out home addresses of all the retired and current law enforcement officers. So that's a great, great place to get information. And the fusion centers, there is a function with the private sector where they can help businesses, too, on events and special intelligence. U.S. CERT is the Emergency Readiness Team at Carnegie Mellon University. They're the ones that do all the chase down on the bad code. And then the FBI's got an economic espionage squad. Ann Hinkle from the FBI is one of the presenters at that May 11th program talking about the espionage. And I know that was very fast, but I think we covered a little bit of ground, and I'm certainly open for any questions. Yes, sir.
What's the situation in Canada right now? Are they facing the similar ominous stuff that you've just talked about in the U.S.?
That's a great question. I actually work with some members of the RCMP that are in their National Intelligence Unit, and they put out a book called Foreign Fighters in ISIL, and it's produced by Canadian Intelligence. And it's an excellent book. It's an inch and a half. Don't read before you go to bed or you won't be sleeping very well. But they have a big issue. Canada, first of all, most folks don't understand Canada is not that big population-wise. You know, I laugh every time everybody says, well, they have this great insurance program. I think they have 16 or 17 million people total in the whole country. But they are really wide open to foreign immigration. And if we get over to the Canadian area of Montreal, between Toronto and Montreal across the northeastern border. Very, very heavy group of individuals that are coming from what we consider hot spots of the world. If you remember the gentleman that tried, use that term loosely, tried to blow up LAX. He came from Canada, drove across the border with a trunk full of explosives. Several of the guys on September 11th came in through Canada. So we've had an ongoing history of the northern border being used from a lot of bad guys coming in. And, you know, we focus on the southern border because it's so crazy with the drugs. But the northern border actually has had a lot of terrorists come out of Canada. And they know about it, and they're trying to work, but they have a very, very hands-off approach. And so RCMP has tried to do, that's Royal Canadian Mounted Police, RCMP, they've tried to do a lot of push, but even the RCMP ranks are heavily based in foreign nationals now. And, you know, there's a lot of internal struggles that are occurring where they're like, oh, we don't need to be looking at them, they're all good people, and yet that's not the truth. If you remember the one individual that shot the soldier at the National War Memorial and then went into Parliament, and but for their sergeant-at-arms shooting him and dropping him, he was going to carry out an attack in Parliament. They had the guy that ran people over with his car and shot. So they've had five or six attacks in the last 2 years that kind of caught their attention. But they have entire enclave areas, almost like France has in certain areas where the immigrant population has got a neighbor and they run their own show. The RCMP goes in there, but every time they go in there, there's a big shootout, and then there's a big national investigation as to why they're shooting. So they know they got a problem. It's growing, and it's not being monitored as well as it should be. But they do have their intelligence unit, and they are doing things. They're doing research, and they're monitoring as they can. But I think my personal opinion is they also have a lack of focus and commitment to the big picture, but it hasn't been significant enough yet. And realistically, for Canada, I'm not sure why anybody would do something major in Canada because they're not going to damage a superpower. They've been participatory with us, participatory in Afghanistan, in NATO, but they're not like a super problem for the bad guys yet. Now, they just elected a very liberal president. So their new administration is very liberal. I doubt they're going to be clamping down anytime soon. But they do have a problem. They know it. In the western part of the country, in British Columbia, they have a lot of Asian gangs and a lot of drug trafficking, and they're occupied with organized crime quite a bit. But the interesting point is the Asian organized crime individuals do not like the terrorists because they interrupt business. Okay, so they kind of kept the lid on it in the western area. But in the eastern area, Toronto to Montreal, they've had a lot of flow, a lot of illegal immigration, and they just don't have a real hardcore system for it yet. Any other questions?
Does ISIL have any training bases in the U.S.?
Well, that's a good question. Now, the problem with that is we have so many training ranges open to the public that it would be really hard to identify whether they have to have a formal training base or five of their guys go to an outdoor public firing range, for example. I go back to a case a long time ago. There were two criminals, the last name of Platt and Maddox, and they were working South Florida robbing banks, and they ended up killing several FBI agents when they were doing the surveillance and tried to take them down. And come to find out, these two have been practicing in the Everglades for a year, firing between 1,000 to 3,000 rounds every weekend in the Everglades. They just went out, found a berm, and were doing target practice with mini-14s and all this other stuff. And so when the FBI engaged them, these guys fought like they were military people. That's how the FBI lost several agents. So in the U.S., if you and I went to Montana or even West Texas, we could be shooting all day and no one's going to know we're doing it out there.
Yeah.
And secondly, if they do, it's legal.
Yeah.
So I guess the way I would look at it, it'd be probably not a bad idea. You might want to read this book.
Yeah.
The way I would look at it is that there certainly are training centers for ISIL, and there's no question they're probably still doing it in the U.S., but they're doing it as citizens.
Yeah.
So I have four other members of my loose association. We go out to an outdoor range and we practice with our rifles on a Saturday afternoon. Nothing suspicious there. But where the other guys are target shooting for accuracy on the target, we're target shooting for a mission. And I'll, real quick, what I would tell you, I observed this at a range one day. Guys were firing close range with rifles. And that was very abnormal for me because we have a training academy. We train personnel to be licensed by Texas DPS for what we do. And I don't train my guys with carbines at short distances. And that was a little bit, that raised up. And so I went and talked to the range guys, and we ended up checking some guys out that were involved in that because that's abnormal for a normal range. pistol shooting at long range, yeah, okay, you're trying to be accurate. But up close shooting with a carbine, that doesn't make a lot of sense. So there are some things that you might see, but that was happenstance. I just happened to be there training some of our personnel, saw what was going on, and that's not right. But there is no overall program. And keep in mind, we can do that kind of stuff, but nobody in the country wants us looking at it right now. And it's back to that scenario of when it's bad enough at home that the public says, okay, the NSA can check phone numbers out and this can be done. And I don't know what that magic balance is between, you know, social liberties and civil liberties and protection. But the country does have to figure it out. And eventually it's going to be a problem because we know they're going to start doing more and more inside the U.S. Anybody else?
Who's the 50th state that doesn't have a
terrorist?
Right. Yeah, we need to know.
Yeah, you know, that's a good one. I actually have the director's testimony in the office, but I never really looked at it. And here's what I would point out to you. I guarantee you there's a whole bunch more that they don't know about, okay? So if they're working investigations in 49 states, there's problems going on in all 50 and a whole lot more than what they're working because people don't understand how many people it takes to work this kind of investigation. And your worst nightmare is it's not two guys, it's like seven of them. So now I got seven of them and their family, and keep in mind most of their family structures are 8 to 10 kids.
Yeah.
They're not 1.2 like American families, okay? Most of these guys have multiple relatives. They live in neighborhoods where a lot of their relatives are. They are in a community where they have extended relatives that run all the stores that they visit and support. And so you have a very hard time penetrating that particular group in their own nationality neighborhood when they have relatives that may not even know what they're up to and would never think badly of their relative. And if you guys have seen this, every time someone goes off and does an attack, their relative's like, I can't believe that. You know, our family's never done things like that, and that's true. So the relative will protect them but have no clue that they're protecting someone up to no good. But I would personally say I'd put money on the fact there's plots going on in all 50 states.
If I had to guess, I'd say Rhode Island.
Yeah, well, you know,
it's a small state, everybody, you know.
It's a pass-through state, and by the way, Rhode Island's got a very heavy Portuguese population, and they don't take nonsense from anybody, and the other rest of the population is Italian. And they don't take any grief from anybody, okay? So, I would agree with that. That would be a very bad place for them to try to operate because everybody there knows what's going on in the neighborhood. That would be very difficult. I grew up on the west side of Chicago, and that neighborhood I grew up in, you couldn't do anything that everybody didn't know about it. You know, the most intelligent analysts in the neighborhood were the great-grandmothers. I mean, they knew everybody who was up to what, whose family had people in prison. I mean, you know, they knew all that stuff. But like I said, it's really anywhere they want to be. And with the influx across the border, there's a really good report that came from Congress, the investigation, you know, Congress a couple years ago called A Line in the Sand, and it's about the southern border. And they documented, this is 4, maybe 5 years ago, they documented the cartels being paid $75,000 per person from the Middle East that they smuggled into the U.S. And quite often, the way they would do it, which show you the cold blood side, they'd have a couple of their mules. Everybody know what a mule is? And they'd bring in 2 or 3 bales of marijuana across the river. Then they'd call the police and say these guys are bringing dope, and they'd all run down there and arrest them. And while they were doing that, they'd cross the river 3 miles north, bringing in the person who paid them to bring them over the border. So the human smuggling by the cartels has been very well documented with a lot of real cases of individuals. It's called OTM, other than Mexican, OTMs from the Middle East. Coming across, and they got lots and lots of cases, and nobody did anything with the report. But it's a good report. If you're interested in border security, it's a great report to read. I've got that on file, too.
Anybody else? I'm sure he'll hang out for a few minutes if you have other questions that pop up in the meantime. So thank you very much, Kevin.
Thank you.